Greg, thank you so very much for that introduction. It really is a pleasure to deliver this particular lecture, which I really thank Dick Santon for giving such a wonderful lecture last year, and because it really inspired my thinking on what we could look back on as it pertains to something that I've been interested in, which is ovarian tissue transplantation. So let me begin with disclosures. First, I am not an historian. I am only going to talk about ovaries. So there was really important news yesterday on testis development, and of course there's been a uterus transplant, but given the length of time, I decided that we would really try and just stick to one organ, and that is going to be the ovary. And the last thing I would say is this was pretty fun. Probably if I gave this lecture a second time, it would be better than this first kind of dry run that we're going to go through today, but for anybody who is interested, this really is a process that allows you to look back over some of the early literature, early descriptions, early recollections about that we all do on a daily basis. And it's interesting how often that what we think about now really has parallels back in historical time. So my interest really has been in the last several years in trying to understand how to develop strategies that would allow us to engineer ovarian constructs that could restore fertility and endocrine function for young women and girls who have a cancer diagnosis where they will be treated with life-preserving chemotherapy or radiation, but those same life-preserving treatments may also render them infertile, and for those children who are prepubertal, may result in their inability to go through pubertal transitions without the aid of exogenous hormones. And so my group has been interested in this, and that was really the origin of this particular talk. And so when I started thinking about fertility restoration and tissue transplant, I could have really done this lecture in about a minute and just said how many transplants there had been and what the exact date was of the first transplant, which was 1885. But as I tried to think about how to talk about where we are, particularly in terms of the way we start thinking about what it means to transplant an organ like the ovary, that tissue that implicitly has the ability to provide generation, and whatever we do will be generationally continued, I thought it would be interesting, and in fact, I have then broadened the theme back to some of the earliest ideas of generation itself, how we even understood what the parts of the ovary were that were necessary for functionality. And then, so that'll be a little bit of the beginning, and then I'm going to tell the tale of three graduate students. I'm currently the dean of the graduate school, and it turns out that there's a little set of short stories about some graduate students that had some pretty big impact on this particular field. And then I'll take you to kind of the enumeration of ovarian tissue transplants, and the interesting thing is that there's very little actual literature other than to say things happened. And so the burden of proof in this particular literature has been very scant. And I think that's something that, as I've looked across this, is something that as we pivot to where we're going forward with this new frontier, it's going to be critical and incumbent on each of us in this discipline that we are more transparent and that we provide more accurate evidence of when the function has, in fact, been restored. So with that as kind of the broad outline, I take us back pre-1650 to literally 2600 BCE, and the notion of what was that part of male or female that would give rise to a next generation really was associated with the male seed. So seed was a common way of describing this thing that would result in the duplication of the man by deposit into a woman. There was no knowledge of a female counterpart seed. It simply was that the seed of the male would be transplanted into the female, and then it would mix and ferment with the female menstrual blood. And if there was accurate fermentation, there would be no more bleeding, and an embryo would ensue. And so in ancient Egyptian mythology, the male semen was literally a seed. And in fact, these seeds, if ejaculated onto the ground, would result directly into a plant. And this can be found not only in hieroglyphics, but also in cartoons. This was one of those that I found on that topic. The link between mating and fertility really does not require an R01. We don't have to think through that. And in fact, in biblical times, again, this notion of the connection between the ejaculate and the development of an offspring was very well known. In Genesis 38, there is description of Onan who spilt his seed on the ground in order to avoid making his sister-in-law pregnant. At the time, seed was directly used. The word for seed was used both for plant seeds as well as animal ejaculates. And so the New International Version describes, but Onan knew that the child would not be his, so whenever he slept with his brother's wife, he spilled his semen on the ground to keep from providing offspring for his brother. So that is that description. If we then go to Asia, the Shruti Shamhita, the Sanskrit medical guide, which is a series of volumes written in Sanskrit, only more recently translated into a variety of languages, including English, had descriptions that were very broad regarding all aspect of medical advice and medical interventions. And as it related to this topic, may Vishnu expand thy uterus. This is directed towards the female. There's a whole book on midwifery. May Vashata bring about the full differentiation of the limbs, so an understanding that there was a developmental process by which the embryo would develop and assume all the limbs of the individual, and the sex of the fetus. May Prajapti sprinkle thy uterus, and mayest thou conceive through the blessing of the Lord of human destiny. May Saravasti and the surgeons of the gods help thee in taking seed. So yet again, the terminology of seed is just completely replete in all of the descriptions that we have from the earliest texts. Aristotle was the first to really try and grapple with this idea of generation and regeneration. And the notion that he had really had to do with spontaneous generation, and that really lived on for multiple centuries. And the notion was that living things could arise from non-living things. This seemed to be logical if you actually simply looked around you. If you looked around, you could see that frogs, in fact, generated out of mud, that rats, in fact, came from sewage, and that bees would come from bulls. In fact, the bulls, there was a very clear description of how you would place the bull, and with the horn setting up, and in fact, within a certain amount of times, bees would come out of the bulls. And so this was something that every person could, in fact, see happen when there was living matter that was becoming decomposed, that in fact there would be the spontaneous generation of any number of insects. And so that observation held sway for, as I said, several centuries. So even as we move forward toward the time of Leonardo da Vinci, and this is the coitus of a hemisected man, which many of you probably have seen images of, this is actually hanging in Windsor Castle. It is in the Royal Gallery of Windsor Castle. And the image I show you here is only half of the image. Wanted to give you a little bit of a clearer image of the hemisected man. He describes this in his mirror writing that is coming out of the mouth of this individual. So this is written in the mirror. That I expose to men the origin of their first and perhaps second reason for existing. So sex, of course, was describing the spark of life as well as the motivating force throughout life, which is Leonardo's description here. And he goes on in his textual material to explicate this further, which is both in mirror writing on the part that you're not seeing in this particular image, as well as in other places. So I think he's describing kind of the psychology of sex as was understood and is probably still understood in the same manner today. And so while that might be right, his anatomy is a little bit weak. And so the penis, of course, here is straight, and it does not remain straight during coitus. There are a series of vessels that he has that are coming down from here, linking a woman's nipples and her uterus. So it was not clear at all during Da Vinci's time that there was anything that was being contributed by the female at all to the development of an embryo. And so that there was somehow this connection that would then allow the woman to know that there was a fetus that was being developed, and that would allow for the breast to be developed at the same time. It also appears in the image that men's semen doesn't come from the testicle, but it does come from the brain through the spinal cord. And this is really in keeping with the thought that, in fact, much of what sprang out as the new individual literally came from a thought. And this is, of course, a little bit antithetical to what we imagine would have been known at the time from working with domesticated animals, and because castration was known at the time, yet these connect the dots didn't seem to happen for some period of time. As we move forward in time, again, Thomas Reynard was a physician who first published in 1560 a book called The Birth of Mankind, otherwise named The Woman's Book. This was one of the most famous books that was published of this era, and in fact, it was in wider circulation than other religious books. And it was a way that was first published multiple times in Latin and then published in English so that it could be read by far more individuals. The Birth of Mankind, newly translated out of Latin, this is from the original front piece of the 1654 book. Sorry about that. The 1654 book, in which it is entreated of all such things, that which chance the woman in thy labor, and all such infirmities which happen unto the infants after they be delivered, and also at the latter end, or in in the third, or I can't remember how this was. I read this to myself several times, but I'm not getting this little old English quite right. But you get the sense that this is what they're describing here is the description for midwives and for women about different aspects of reproductive health. And in fact, there are a whole series of ways to abort a fetus that are also listed with specific amounts of various herbs and various ways to place it and to provide it to the individual. Interestingly, again, still that even though the womb is the female, everything is said in the masculine. So in chapter 6 of The Birth of Mankind, of the womb and his parts. The womb is really thought of at this time as the housing for the male semen, for the male seed. And so it's really just being used as an addition to, or as a addition to what the male is requiring in order for there to be gestation. So really, what was so hard to sort out? Again, if you kind of think about this logically, it's a little bit kind of anti-intuitive, except sometimes science really works like this, that until something is really done or said, until that paradigm shift occurs, it just really doesn't all make sense. So as you read across this literature, and in fact, this was really from the Greco-Roman time, but you also see this across the Arab literature, it just wasn't all clicking together, even though the management of reproduction was actively being done with the animals that were being handled at the same time. Well, maybe, and I have no idea, this is a supposition, if you look at this particular time, there were a lot of things that really just weren't adding up. And the 1600s really were a time when things changed radically in the way we began to understand the world around us. And so in this time, there was the notion of the transmutation of metals. Alchemy was one of the major outputs of chemists to try and figure out how to create gold out of a number of things. Spontaneous generation, as I mentioned, the Aristotelian notion of how insects arrive from bees come from a bull. This still was the notion of the day, and this is how physicians actually thought about the world around us, how insects came around. The existence of medical panaceas, and then the universe itself. Galileo at this time and the development of telescopes are now pointing out into the world beyond and are now challenging the worldview as it related to kind of religious thinking. So there really was a lot happening at the time that was driven, that is all a little bit confusing as we look back historically, that really just didn't quite add up. And Thomas Randolph, writing to Ben Jonson, has this little fragment, and I just pulled a little bit of this, that reflects some of these different major questions. And it really does reflect the fact that that humanity was still struggling. It didn't quite all add up. And so the questions still were being presented in this way. How elements does change? What is the cause of generation? What the rules and laws? The orbs does move by. And then it goes on into other things. But these three lines kind of capture this top part, these different questions that were still unanswered at that time or just didn't quite add up or quite make sense. In addition, it was really just the time when the human body was beginning to be dissected. And so the human body was thought to be very sacrosanct, and so being able to dissect it and really understand different parts of it was just now beginning. And in particular, hysterical virgins were those that were oftentimes those that were being dissected. When one did dissect females, the fallopian tube the fallopian tube was connected to the uterus. It wasn't connected to the ovary. So that line is wrong, but there's an open tube here. So it really wasn't clear anatomically that the ovary had anything to do with generation. So it took a long time to understand what that relationship actually was. There was a sex-based view of the world that, in fact, generation really had nothing to do with females other than the incubation in his womb. And so the homunculus, the idea eventually, and we haven't gotten to that in our timeline, where there is a fully formed image within the male sperm becomes something that is continually part of this sex-based view of the world. There were not the right model systems available, and I'm going to describe two model systems, one of which that led William Harvey to a dead end in his attempt to understand generation. And then later, Reynard de Graaff, who then used a different model system and was able to come to a very different conclusion. So that represented some of the reasons that this was only now coming of the time. It's also the case that instruments were being developed. So von Leeuwenhoek and the microscopes were now just being developed. And in fact, it's really interesting that you look at this time and barometers and gauges for measuring things. There are a lot of instruments that were being developed in this time, particularly in Italy and across the Arab world, that are allowing us to do better measurements and to begin to look up into the starry, starry night and to begin to appreciate the world beyond. But those instruments that allowed one to look inside were still shatteringly small in number. And in fact, one of the three stories that I'll tell you about, Reynard de Graaff, one of the things that Jan Swammerdam, is most famous for, is not his contribution to our understanding of generation, but his contribution to the development of an enema tube. Did I say that right? An enema tube. So that physicians could allow patients to deliver their own enema. And this is the status of where we are medically at the time, with really just tubes and very not very sophisticated instrumentation. And on top of that is the fact that the scientific method has to be invented in order for there to be the opportunity to do the kind of experiments necessary to disprove spontaneous generation. So Sir Francis Bacon is the first in 1620 to really begin to invent what it is we understand today as the term science. And in fact, once you have science, you now have to have scientists. And those scientists then have to follow a very systematic way of making observations, deriving those quality facts, documenting them, and then providing them to the wider world to be able to analyze them. And so we didn't have a way of systematizing what we were observing, and so that allowed for many of the things that I just showed on the last slide to be continued. And so Sir Francis Bacon says that, in fact, there are five things that have to be accounted for in order for there to be a scientific method. First, whatever it is that we're talking about has to be repeatable. You have to be able to do it over and over. And in Padua at the time, in Italy, provando e riprovando, test and test again, the motto of the Accademia di Chimica, represents this notion of repeatability. Economy means that it shouldn't take a lot of steps for you to understand something. So spontaneous generation, and I think I have a slide in here where you have to take dirty shirts and you pour water on it, and then you put some wheat in it, and then you wait, and then you have to leave it open, and then mice will appear. So what he said is that for a scientific method, you should be able to do reductionist thinking. You should be able to isolate the individual step that you're trying to understand and be able to prove those individual steps. It should be measurable on a universal scale. Up until this point, there was no description that of people repeating each other's science. And so, again, because we hadn't invented the scientific method. So it had to be true in different settings, and for it to be true, it had to be done in different settings. So weights and measures, again, started to now become similarly weighed around the world because of this edict of measurable on a universal scale. It was heuristic, that is, as you came to an answer, a new question would spring up, that if science is being done in the right way, it continually propels itself forward. There is yet a new door to come. And then ultimately, consilience, that as you're asking one question over here, it will begin to make sense so that you begin to see different parts of the pulmonary system of being able to take air in and out of the lungs in a way that is consistent. And so that represented what he called the new organum, the new method for science, novum organum scientiarum. And that is opposed to what was until that time Aristotle's organum. And this represents a real change in the way we can now look at things like the recipe for spontaneous generation. So as a consequence of the scientific method being developed, people then did start writing down what the recipe would be to get bees from bulls, or from getting mice from dirty shirts. And so here is one of the most widely described recipes for mice, Van Helmont's recipe for mice. Place dirty rags or dirty shirts in an open pot or barrel containing grains of wheat or some wheat bran. And in fact, there's literature that you can read that really is trying to get very specific about how many grains of wheat. And is it really wheat, or is it some, or can other sources like corn actually work? And then the 21 days, the mice will appear. There will be adult males and females present. So Van Helmont is in fact describing what the outcome should be, and they will be capable of reproducing more mice. So he is described then as an experimentalist. But of course, now because he has published this method, there is now the ability to go back and do the experiments where, in fact, you put a cloth over the top of the barrel and ask if you still get mice 21 days later, or where you have the putrefying body of a small animal where bees should emerge to actually, in fact, put some kind of cloth over and find that the maggots are actually laid on top. And it is this experimentation. So you would think that Van Helmut has now got it all wrong. But in fact, the fact that he did this experimental method allowed the field to almost overnight go from a spontaneous generation, as the description in all the literature, to never describing spontaneous generation again. And in fact, it's almost lost entirely from the literature. Now, he got the life sciences a little bit wrong, but as a chemist, he was a little better. He was the one who actually experimentally disproved the transmutation of metal, that the mass of metal had to be accounted for in a chemical process was actually his claim to fame. So if you look for Van Helmont in the chemistry literature, you'll find him. If you look for him in our life science literature, you won't even find him. Well, the question of generation really... Actually, was I on this slide? Okay, good, because I can't tell which slide. Okay, right, I went the wrong way. I'm telling you, this talk will be much better next time I give it, so thank you for hanging in there with me. Well, the next story I'm going to tell you is now how we now did get to the principles of the egg and the sperm. The sperm, I've told you, and we've known about the sperm from antiquity, largely because it's easy to see and it's easy to correlate. But the question of generation, what was it that, was there anything that was being contributed by the female is continuing to be not well understood. And so the next part of the story really is the story of two royalists, George Ent, who was part of the Royal Academy of Science, which had also just been developed. Sir Francis Bacon, I forgot to tell that part of the story, Sir Francis Bacon is able to develop a society. The first scientific society is or originates with Bacon. It's not given a lot of money from the royal house. It was given enough to get started, and then essentially it becomes a place where people have to convene and bring their recipes and actually bring their products. And those products, if they can't be brought to test, then two members of the Royal Society are sent out to, in fact, do or watch the experiment take place in order to certify that particular experiment. Well, so George Ent, who is on your left, was the secretary of the Royal Society, and on your right is an image of William Harvey. And many of you will know William Harvey as the one who really described the circulatory system. At the end of his life, he was really consumed with this idea of generation. And so he is late in his life. He's about 70 years old, and he's very weary. And on one Christmas time, George Ent decided he was going to make a call on his old friend William Harvey. He himself is having dark shadows, and so he thinks if he goes and visits Harvey, Harvey will lift his spirits and he will wipe those dark shadows away. And so he goes to Harvey's house and finds him. Harvey at this time is consumed with gout. He is unhappy. And Ent comes and starts to try and talk with him. Ent is the one that actually helped to circulate his treatise on circulation. And in fact now has a publishing house. So it's probably the case that Ent is trying to fish for any last pieces that Harvey might have, because that will certainly be very... readily publishable. And so they're talking about the state of court politics. William Harvey had been the physician to Charles, James I and Charles II. I might be wrong on that. The one and two might be switched. Now there's been a great upheaval in the political time, and the royalists are out of favor. And so he has now lost his wealth as a consequence of this change. And so Ent and Harvey are continuing to talk about this, and Ent says, "Well, is there anything else that you have written? Have you thought of anything else?" And Harvey then begins to open up and say that in fact he has a whole new treatise on the generation of animals, and so he decides that he will give this to Ent, and Ent goes away a very happy man, because in fact it becomes ultimately a bestseller, which is goes into four different Latin editions. You can tell I took this lecture very seriously to figure all this out, right? So there are 72 chapters in this book on generation, and there's absolutely no illustrations. So it's a good thing I looked at this, and you don't have to, because it's a little bit circuitous what's happening. But essentially, there's some really excellent descriptions of mating ostriches. There are some then experimental studies really that are associated with viviparous and oviparous species. And so what Harvey is trying to understand is there any contribution that the female makes to generation at all? And so he actually ultimately comes to the conclusion that all animals whatsoever, even viviparous creatures, nay, man himself, all are engendered from an egg. The first conceptions of all living creatures from which the fetus arises are some kind of egg. So he's making this absolute statement, and he's now going against what Aristotle has said, and he's very worried about this, but what he ultimately describes is all things come from an egg, and this is the front piece to his De Generatione Animalium. And if you actually zoom in on Zeus, so God is holding an egg, and from it, all things are coming out fully formed. And on the egg, it says, ex ovo omni, all things come from an egg. So the key to understanding all generation was the existence of an egg. Now, that really is a whole new way of thinking for scientists. And it required him to go out, and part of his book is describing the 40 or so years that he was on King James land, and he would go and dissect hinds, the deer that were on the land soon after copulation. And he would then dissect very specific times after copulation. And the thing that he would do is he would identify the uterus, he would identify all the various structures, and he would see this thing called the ovary, and he just wouldn't care anything about it. He would see these ball-like structures on the surface, and the thing he never did was to cut right down through the middle of it. He could not see the ovary as a worthwhile entity. So while he posited that, in fact, all things, ex ovo omni, everything comes from the egg, in the final section of his book, Harvey speculated about what he called the dark business of conception. He still could not come up with any rational, anatomical, or experimental way to, in fact, describe where the egg came from. And so Roger Short, who is a member of this society, in 1973, went back to Harvey's original book and repeated the experiments that Harvey did out in the glades of King James Land. And in fact, because this is where the model system becomes the problem that I mentioned in the earlier slide, it turns out that the that copulation is not what induces ovulation in the deer. And so, in fact, he was never able to see the oocyte. And in fact, after he dissected the uterus over time, the development of the embryo is so small that, in fact, he, without good instruments, the second thing that I said was a real problem during this time, could not, in fact, be able to visibly see the embryo at a time that was associated with development. So all he could conclude at the end of this work is that that it must come from an egg. That was what he decided and he posited. But it must be some other dark business. There must be some fumes that come up from the semen that somehow introduce themselves to get this development. So this is actually a movie that comes from Roger Short from 1973. It was given to Matthew Cobb, who wrote a brilliant book called The Egg and Sperm Race. And it was on Matthew's website, and he took it down about 20 years ago. And it is now formally in the British Library. And Matthew was able to get a copy of this to me, and I was able to make it run, and it was able to run on this computer here. And so what you're about to see is a little bit of Roger Short's recreation of the original William Harvey experiments. This is a long thing, so I'm going to just pick up at a couple of places through the movie.
Thank you.
we're in the bucolic hinterlands of King George's Land. And in fact, what they go through is this is one of the professors who is playing William Harvey. And then Roger Short will come in and he will tell you why Harvey got it wrong, which you'll want to hear a little bit of Roger Short. For those of you who know Roger Short, you'll want to hear this little clip.
Substance. The entire colliquimentum being cast into a silver basin. Emitted
and ovulation by a month. Nor did he appreciate that it was the female that produced the egg, which was so small as to be invisible to the naked eye for 10 days after fertilization. Finally, even when he did see the developing embryo at the end of October, he dismissed it as purulent matter.
So I'll stop right there, but that gives you, I think if nothing else, this history lecture allowed us to uncover a piece of historical film that I think is going to be quite useful in the future. So I'm nearing the end of time, and so what essentially has been happening is trying to understand the notion of follicles of the ovary. So the follicles were not understood. The ovary itself was detached from the fallopian tube. It did not seem like the ovary had anything to do with generation because it was away from the reproductive, from the womb. These follicles were not known, and certainly the egg was not known, and the development of an embryo by the insemination with a sperm was not known. So this leads us to the story of three PhDs, all young men going to Leiden University. And they are three brilliant medical doctors who are getting their PhD there. And Neil Stenson, who defines the stenoduct, John Swammerdam, who is studying respiration, and Reynard de Graaf are all interested in various aspects of our tripartite mission of clinical aspect, of clinical research, and then of pure research. And they're going to Leiden at a time when there is a great awakening in Leiden, in the Netherlands. This is a time when the shipping is moving goods and services and people, unfortunately, around the globe. Pottery and textiles, many of that is coming out of the Netherlands. And Leiden University is now the most progressive university in the Western world. And it is for two reasons. One is they build a botanical garden with all the medicinals that can now be tested under the scientific technology that Francis Bacon described that I indicated earlier. And secondly, they create an amphitheater. And this amphitheater now is allowed for human anatomy to be studied by more than the number of people who could surround a single corpse. And so these three men, and if I had time, I have stories to tell you, but I don't. And so Reynard de Graaf was the one who first identified that these balls that are associated with the ovary actually, which he called the female testicles, would in fact be the egg that Harvey described. So he's in fact describing the follicle, and so today the Graafian follicle is named for him. But there still was this problem that this whole thing couldn't traffic down the fallopian tube. And so that led eventually to Bayer, who was the first to, in fact, describe the mammalian ovum. But he had 50 more years and the development of the microscope that allowed for...
Coming thinned out and...
allowed for the imaging of ovulation to occur. And so he was the first to see, in fact, that there was a thinning of the outer wall and a movement of the egg from the inside to the outside. So ovulation is just about to happen. There is the rupture zone. And this is what Bayer discovered and actually describes in his image. So with that, I am going to actually conclude. And I have not gotten to the last bit, which I'm going to just go to, which is the ovarian tissue transplants. So the first ovarian tissue transplants were done in 1895. They were done actually from an adult woman to a female patient who had a delay in sexual maturity. And it was described by William Morris that 8 weeks after transplantation, the patient had menses. It's unlikely this was actually the case. These transplants, unless there was some really remarkable genetics that were certainly not described by Morris, But he goes on to describe that the patient, in fact, gave birth. The next transplant was a 17-year-old into a 29-year-old because the 29-year-old had menopausal symptoms. And so she returned to erotic dreams in 6 days, menstruation 1 day later, and the patient had regained her mental and physical equilibrium. Her coloring was good, and she looked well 8 months later. So ovarian tissue transplants, if you look at the literature, 236 titles of papers between 1900 and 1952. This is more than thyroid transplants, which were some of the first transplants to occur. And then if we actually look forward to the time of IVF, the first embryo to be developed was in 1944 by Miriam Minkin. And then the modern era of transplantation, and this will be the slides that I end on, there are now more than 130 live births from ovarian tissue transplant that have come from those cancer patients that I described earlier, where one ovary or a biopsy is taken out, is cryopreserved, and then transplanted to a patient later. In the United States, there are 23 live births that have occurred. This is the quilting of those outer cortices that are cryopreserved, and into a cancer patient where the FSH is menopausal levels, those FSH levels come down and the AMH actually rises. And this is one of the cases from last week. This is Sherm Silber's lab at St. Louis. These are two of my students, an MD PhD student and a master's student who came from Steve Hamas's lab. And this is one of the babies that has been born in America to this technology. So the hope is that eventually these transplants will be developed so that we don't have to use the tissues for transplant, because those tissues come out from a patient prior to that first sterilizing treatment, which means the cancer cells may still be embedded within them. And so I think with that, that's where I will end this historical lecture. And I really, again, want to thank you for the honor of giving this lecture. I learned a lot, and I look forward to continuing to develop in this particular area. Thank you, Greg.